You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And once again, joining us, Ian Boswell.
Hey, Richard.
Hello, Ian. Hello, Lionel. My head is spinning. I feel a bit dizzy after a day of trying to keep up with three different bike races. What were the practicalities of this for you, Lionel? How did you manage this?
Well, I made myself a cappuccino and a Belgian waffle, and then I had some ham on.
I might have known there'd be a food-based answer to this.
I was stocked up.
Did you watch the racing at all, or did you just eat?
I did watch the racing as well, but, you know, whilst sort of licking my fingers and reaching for plates of things, I did miss some crucial action. No, it was good fun, wasn't it? Because everything was quite well coordinated today. There was the women's race at Depana, and then the Giro finished, got out of the way in time for us to watch the exciting bit of the Vuelta. So it's perfect.
There was one odd moment when I was watching the Vuelta and the Giro simultaneously, and Ben O'Connor attacked of NTT, and at the same time an NTT rider crashed at the Vuelta. I mean, you shouldn't laugh about that, but it was just the sort of differing fortunes of NTT at that precise moment. I can imagine Doug Ryder watching it going, yes, oh.
I was wondering whether, I was laughing because I was thinking that would just feed into your confusion about what on earth was going on. I found it quite confusing on Sunday. I know you were at the Tour of Flanders, Richard, but Eurosport, they switched between the Tour of Flanders and the Giro. And I wasn't aware they were going to be doing this. So I went out of the room to make a cup of tea, left them heading towards one of the cobbled climbs. And when I came back in, they were on an Italian Alp. It was very confusing.
I was watching the Vuelta and became convinced at one point that I could see Diego Ulisi. And I thought, how on earth has he done that? Amazing. Amazing. A mid-race transfer.
You joke, but there is one rider, Alexander Vlasov, who's riding the Vuelta, having started the Giro, pulled out of the Giro on stage two with stomach problems. That confusion. We only saw a fleeting glimpse of Vlasov in the Giro, didn't we? But he's been allowed to start the Vuelta. But it's going to be quite some week watching a couple of races. And in the case of tomorrow, the men's race at Depana as well.
And Ian, how did you manage this logistical puzzle?
To be quite honest, I did not watch Depana this morning. I woke up and I did watch the final hour or so of the Giro, and then because I'm in the US, I don't have Eurosport. I'm sure there's a way I could get a VPN and figure it out. But then I switched from Flow Bikes over to NBC, two different carriers for watching the race. And so I was able to watch both. But with the slow Wi-Fi at my house, I don't think I could stream both events at the same time. So I'm just hoping that all the action comes at the end so I can catch both events.
Well, I hope both stages have now finished for you, have they?
Just about.
Before we discuss them. That's a relief. Wow. Well, in this episode, we're going to hear from Joe Dombrowski, whose Team UAE, Team Emirates, has been at the centre of the latest COVID case to affect the Giro. We'll hear from him a bit later on. And we're going to divide the podcast up, I think, into parts as we discuss the three races. But Lionel, do you have not a tale of the tapas, but headlines from the day?
Yeah, headlines from the day. Well, what a day it was for Slovenia, because at the Giro, Jan Tratnik of Bahrain McLaren won stage 16.
And I just have to say, can I just say one thing about this? Sorry, I know I'm breaking the rules already here, but in his post-stage interview, he said that he attacked at the point in the course where his girlfriend was standing. Now, who has done that in the past? It's Primož Roglič, another Slovenian. Do you remember that we did an event in the Alps at our friend Shali Zietaz a couple of years ago? We met some Slovenians who told us that Roglič always attacks at the point where his girlfriend is standing. And they were expecting him to do the same the next day on Alpe d'Huez. So anyway, just must be a Slovenian thing. Sorry, Lionel, carry on.
Well, it was apt anyway, a Slovenian victory in the Giro, because they were tucked around the top northeastern corner of Italy, very close to the Slovenian border. We'll talk about the Giro in part three of today's podcast. Before that, in part two, we will discuss a controversial sprint finish at the women's race in Dapana. And in part one, we will kick off with another Slovenian victory, Primož Roglič, who attacked where his girlfriend was standing on the course, I think, today, to win.
Roglič again, did that again.
I don't know. But you said that they always do. This
always.
This is a Slovenian thing. They always do this. So, well, yeah, Primož Roglič, the defending champion, picked up in the Vuelta where he left off. He is in the red jersey again after winning stage one in the Basque Country. I mean, it was a real tour of the Basque Country, or Itzulia-style stage, wasn't it? I mean, an absolute humdinger. The Vuelta is already whittled down to sort of half a dozen or so contenders after just 173 kilometres. I mean, there was no preamble whatsoever, no team time trial, no prologue. Obviously, the race was supposed to start in the Netherlands, wasn't it? But those three stages are impossible because of the coronavirus situation. But I just thought it was as if somebody had called last orders at the pub and said that there weren't going to be enough drinks to go round. That was how they approached it.
It's like a pub brawl, Lionel.
Absolutely. It was like a pub brawl, yeah. They went at it on the last couple of climbs. And, well, we don't know who's going to win the Vuelta, but we do have a pretty good idea that Chris Froome and Thibaut Pinot won't be winning the Vuelta. They lost absolute fistfuls of time. So we'll talk about the Vuelta after this.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWaka. If you run a business, find out more at iWaka.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Thank you very much to iWaka for sponsoring the cycling podcast. If you run a small business and you would like to have a look at the services that iWaka offer, go to iWaka.co.uk and have a look through the website. Flexible loans, basically, for your small business, whether you need a small amount of money or a large amount of money for whatever purpose to get your business from this stage to the next stage. They promise a fast decision. You can get a yes or no from iWaka within 24 hours in the vast majority of cases. Very quick to apply online. And then when you do deal with iWaka directly, you'll be dealing with actual people. So you get a kind of personal service as well. Go to iWaka.co.uk if that sounds like the sort of service your business could need.
So the Vuelta, chaps, I think we're starting off with the Vuelta tonight, aren't we? And just a note on that, one thing that we've done this year is we've recruited teams of diarists, audio diarists, at the Tour de France, the Giro, and at the Vuelta too. And we're delighted to have Nick Dlamini of NTT keeping an audio diary, Nick Schultz of Michelin Scott, who kept an audio diary for us last year at the Vuelta, and Scott Davis at Bahrain McLaren. So the three of them will be checking in with us and keeping us updated. We can send them questions as well, so if any of you have questions for them, pass them on to us. Also, Mitch Docker of EF Pro Cycling and George Bennett of Jumbo Visma will be keeping us updated from time to time. We're going to check in with them as well and hopefully get an insight into how their race is doing. George Bennett, obviously, could be particularly interesting on the team that he's on. He rode well today. He's also the subject of today's Kilometre Zero, powered by Zwift, our Kilometre Zero series. So the latest episode is a chat with George Bennett, looking ahead to the Vuelta. And they were such a dominant team at the Tour de France. He said they weren't going to ride the Tour, the Vuelta, in the same way, i.e. kind of controlling it. And I think from the evidence of today's stage, it might be difficult to do that anyway, because as you said, Lionel, it looked chaotic. The number of sort of possible winners has already been quite drastically whittled down. And the Vuelta anyway is always kind of a different beast to the Tour de France. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't help starting the Basque Country, does it? Because the racing there, well, the roads there don't lend themselves to controlled racing. It's pretty chaotic, up and down, steep hills and small roads. And it was a cracking start to the race, I thought.
Yeah, it was, Richard. And, well, we've seen the riders that have risen to the top. I mean, Primoz Roglic, the defending champion, just ahead of Richard Carapaz in the sprint finish. Dan Martin of Israel Startup Nation third. Esteban Chavez of Mitchelton Scott. Felix Groschartner of Bora Hansgrohe, Enric Mas of Movistar, and Hugh Carthy of EF Pro Cycling. Then Sepp Kuss and George Bennett a little way back. And then you're talking almost a minute to the next group. And Dumoulin, Valverde, Nieve, De La Cruz were in there. But then the big casualties, of course, Thibaut Pinot and Chris Froome. And, well, 24 hours ago, Chris Froome was talking as if the Vuelta was a matter of joint leadership on Ineos Grenadiers with Richard Carapaz, and now having lost 11 minutes and 12 seconds to the Roglic Carapaz group, that is that is not the case, is it? And it was ironic, really, that the point where Froome was in trouble on the succession of climbs coming into the finish, it was around sort of 18-20 kilometers from the finish, and it was when Ineos were setting a really fast pace, and the other team that were up there were Israel Startup Nation. For Dan Martin. I mean, Dan Martin was prominent. So his current team and his future team were driving the pace at the point where Froome was in difficulty. And it does look like a long road back for him. I mean, over 3 weeks, there's plenty of time to, ride himself up to the level and contest for stages, maybe getting breaks and so on. But the overall challenge for this Vuelta is gone on day one for him, and it does already look like a shootout between Roglic and Carapaz, last year's Vuelta and Giro champions.
I was surprised to flip over from the Giro to the Vuelta and see the race coming apart. And you know, this, as you said, it is in the Basque Country, and there's almost no way to make a flat course there. And to see such an exciting race on stage one was, it's awesome. I don't know as a fan if it's actually going to make the race more exciting because people will be able to go up in breaks, or if it is going to kind of nullify and just limit, the GC contenders to five guys in the first couple of days. But I also saw that, unfortunately, Mike Woods also crashed out and lost some time, and I think he was going pretty well coming into this race. I'm a little bit kind of confused as to why Froome was kind of speaking the way he was, you said just 24 hours ago, because the team surely, Ineos and Tim Carrison surely knew what kind of form he was in. I'm sure Froome did as well. And to be quite honest, just with, how few races have been on the calendar this year, I know that there's a lot of races going on now and teams are kind of running low rosters, just trying to, make sure everyone's safe and healthy at the end of the season. But, why Froome is actually, to be honest, why he's at this race, if they're there to try to win it, I think Froome definitely wants to be there just to really get racing in and get a Grand Tour in his legs before next year. But with Ineos Grenadiers knowing that he's leaving teams, is that in a way benefiting, Israel for 2021, giving him the opportunity to do a long race like this? And, obviously Froome has been with that organization for a long time now, and it's, probably a good way for him to kind of go out. But I mean, to be honest, being a former teammate of Froome's and a friend, it's honestly kind of sad to see him like just continually struggling. I know this isn't the first time this year that, maybe us fans have thought that Froome was going to be back to his former level, and stage one, it wasn't even like he was bluffing to, he was on a bad day. He just straight up got dropped, but you did see his determination. I mean, the fact that he just kept fighting for so long is just a testament to Froome's mental fortitude. And I think we'll continue to see that throughout these next 18 stages, but I he could come better by the end. But yeah, it's like you said, a long road back from where he was.
Well, let's hear what he said at the finish, shall we?
Great day for us with Richie coming second, right up there still in GC. I mean, he's our team leader here, and we're going to be helping him as much as we can throughout the race to try and get us the victory overall. For me personally, I got a bit caught out coming into the penultimate climb and started pretty far back and stuck behind the crash at the bottom there. I'm really happy to be here, really happy to be racing a Grand Tour again after 2 years of not doing any Grand Tours. Just going to take the race day by day and keep trying to do as much for the team as I can throughout the race. I still miss a little bit of that top end from not having raced much, but definitely an improvement, and hope to keep building throughout the race.
Well, that was Froome speaking at the finish, and you know the language changed quite a lot in 24 hours. He's speaking there as though it wasn't a surprise, and he wasn't particularly disappointed. He said he was sort of caught in the wrong place, but I don't think those 11 minutes that he lost were due to positioning. His fitness is just not there, is it? And we've seen it since racing resumed that it's not the Froome of old. He did talk about the importance of getting a Grand Tour in his legs, having not ridden one this year or last year. The last Grand Tour he finished was the 2018 Tour de France, wasn't it? Where he was third behind Dumoulin and Geraint Thomas. It feels like quite a long time ago. So who knows whether getting round the Vuelta might just be enough for him to go into the winter and work hard at regaining the form. But it's hard to see any way back for him. You know, I heard him on the radio this morning talking about wanting to try and win a fifth Tour de France. It's almost impossible to imagine that. But those who are close to Froome, those who know him well, and Ian, you probably have some insight into this, say that he's the most determined, most dedicated individual they've ever come across, and that if anybody can do that, it's Chris Froome.
You know, I've said that to multiple people who ask me, even, you know, running up into the tour, I was, you know, I think before he wasn't selected for the team, I thought if there was someone who could come back from that injury and return to that same level, it would be Froome. But we've really seen so many kind of new names rise to the top of, you know, of Grand Tour GC contenders. And I think, you know, Nibali made a comment the other day over at the Giro, kind of saying that, you know, these young riders, it's a different game. And I think that, you know, Froome, is he going to be, what, 36 next year, 37?
36, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's getting up there for being a Grand Tour rider, especially just, you know, to be honest, saying what you just said, I have raced a Grand Tour more recently than Chris Froome. I did the 2018 Vuelta after the tour. So who knows, maybe I could make a comeback and
I wouldn't rule it out, Ian. I wouldn't rule it out. But I mean, for those the riders that did shine today, Roglic is just who does he remind me of? I thought today, Sean Kelly. You know, it's just that relentlessness, that consistency in his level of performance. He just doesn't really dip at all. He won this race last year. He's very good in a finish like that, isn't he? He's pretty fast. And it was kind of perfect for him. Hugh Carthy had a really good go. I mean, they had a terrible day at EF with Danny Martinez, first of all, and then Mike Woods having nasty crashes. I was quite surprised at Vlasov. He lost over 4 minutes today. He was a sort of dark horse for me. But I think of the guys sort of stuck behind Dumoulin, I would not rule him out. You know, he's lost a minute today, but I don't think I would rule him out of the GC picture in this race, because today wasn't a stage that would have really suited him. And I think once we get deeper into the race and that time trial, I mean, George Bennett said that he thought the overall would pretty much be decided by the stage 13 time trial. I think he's still in it. It could be a sort of topsy-turvy race, but yeah, it was interesting. I mean, Sepp Kuss for me was the man of the day in a lot of ways, just the way that he rode up the climb. It was a pity that he lost a handful of seconds in the end, but he looks incredible, and on any other team he would be the protected rider.
Well, I mean, they're off to a flyer, aren't they, Jumbo-Visma? I mean, Dumoulin 51 seconds back, Hessink was in that group as well, and then, as you say, Bennett and Kuss and the stage winner, and they've got the red jersey. But I mean, on Roglic, you say relentless. I mean, mentally so strong. I mean, think back, it's exactly a month today since the Tour de France finished, and I know he was smiling on the Champs-Élysées and he was very magnanimous in defeat, but just how crushing that is, a career-ending defeat almost. Not the fact that that he lost the Tour de France after leading it for so long, but just the manner of that time trial. And you could understand anyone suffering almost a sort of traumatic response to that, and wanting to kind of just you know, put the bike away for a few weeks and just think about anything else. And obviously he's taking a completely opposite approach to getting over that defeat, and I suspect refusing to allow his career to be defined by the defeat to Tadej Pogacar in the Tour de France. I mean, already, you know, he came back, he looked very strong at the World Championships. You know, there was obviously that little moment of controversy when some people thought he should have helped out his Jumbo-Visma teammate Wout van Aert in the final there, but then won Liège-Bastogne-Liège and now picking up where he left off in the Vuelta. And with a team that he's got behind him, he's going to be very, very difficult to beat. And already, well, I think it is straight shootout between Roglic and Carapaz. And just a final little correction, of course, Roglic's girlfriend wasn't standing where he attacked today, if indeed she was there at all, because she's now his wife.
Well, chaps, before we move on to the 3 days of Dapana, which is obviously a one-day race for women and a one-day race for men over 2 days, but in Dapana, which is at least something, the Vuelta mugs made by Stacey Snyder. Ian, you're a proud owner of a Stacey Snyder cycling podcast mug, I think, aren't you?
I am indeed. I drink my... It's my mug I use more for tea than coffee, but I drink my tea out of it every night.
Great. Well, Stacey made another batch, her final Grand Tour batch. There's Lionel holding up his mug there. She made her final Grand Tour batch of the season, and they sold out very quickly, as they always do. Huge thank you to Stacey. Her hard work is very much appreciated, and she always sends them out, posts them out the next day very efficiently. They can take a while to get to some people in some parts of the world, but be patient, they will arrive. And thank you very much if you bought one of Stacey's mugs, either here at the Giro or at the Tour de France. The Giro and Vuelta mugs are benefiting the Bahati Foundation in Los Angeles and the Black Cyclist Network in the UK. We've been delighted and proud to support some great causes this year, so there'll be checks winging their way from Stacey. All the proceeds go to those good causes. Thank you, Stacey. And a bit of news from us. We have a new partnership. It's a kind of cementing of an old partnership, LACA Bike Insurance. We've got a long relationship with them. They've been advertising in the podcast for a few years now. And they came to us wanting to step it up a bit, make it a bit more, I don't know, move from courting into a sort of a marriage between the cycling podcast and LACA. Now, if you sign up to LACA Bike Insurance, you will be directly supporting the cycling podcast. LACA have a lot of cycling podcast listeners as customers, and they're keen to gather them together as a community within their greater community. It's something that will develop. So if you sign up to LACA now as a cycling podcast customer, you will be part of the cycling podcast community there. And there'll be other announcements that we'll make in due course about benefits and various perks and so on. It's the same sign-up process as before. Go to laca.co.uk and enter the code TCP, and that will automatically put you into the cycling podcast community. If you are an existing LACA customer and you signed up as a cycling podcast listener, you will automatically be put into that community. So that's exciting, and we're very grateful to LACA for coming to us with this suggestion and for allowing the podcast to benefit directly from this initiative. So thank you to LACA, and go to laca.co.uk and sign up with TCP. Well, on to the 3 days of Dapana, two single day races for men and women. And I think these races would have made more sense if Paris-Roubaix was still on as a sort of bridge between Flanders and Roubaix. As it is, they are now the kind of end of the one day classics, and a little bit of a damp squib, with no disrespect to Dapana, but not quite the kind of going out on a high that, you know, Paris-Roubaix would have provided. It's always a sprinter's race. We're expecting that tomorrow with the men's race. And today's finished with a sprint. And it was won, well, Yolene Dora of Bulls Dolmans crossed the line first. She was then relegated. And Lorena Vibus of Team Sunweb was given the victory. And, well, Sunweb tried... I mean, Lorena Vibus joined Sunweb mid-season from Park Hotel Valkenburg. And... that was quite a sort of controversial move, but she's a fantastic rider, a great sprinter. Hasn't really clicked yet with Sunweb, and they had a big lead out for her today, and it didn't really work. It was disrupted. Yolene Dora jumped early and got quite a gap, and then kind of drifted across the road, closed the door on Vibus as she started coming from behind, and it was deemed an illegal manoeuvre. I didn't feel it was. I've seen a lot worse. I thought Arnaud Démare's maneuver on Peter Sagan at the Giro earlier was more dramatic, and at that point Sagan was actually kind of on Démare's shoulder, so it was more dangerous in my view. In this case, Dour started drifting when Vibus was a good length or so behind, and then Vibus tried to go through the gap as it was closing. So I didn't think it was that dangerous, and I think if you jump first and get that gap, you kind of earn the right to move a little bit and close the door on somebody if you want. I mean, the rules are a bit vague on
that.
Well,
before we hear from Ian, let's say what the UCI rule is. It's rule 2.3.036 on sprints, and this is all it says. It says riders shall be strictly forbidden to deviate from the lane they selected when launching into the sprint, and in so doing endangering others. Now, the interpretation of that from those words is that Dura did deviate from the line she selected, but she actually deviated from the line she selected by going round another rider early on in the sprint. That was after she'd launched her sprint. So the rule is, on the one hand, well, it's either not fit for purpose or it's deliberately allowing the commissaires plenty of room for interpretation. And I suspect, I don't want to prejudice what Ian's going to say from the rider's point of view, but the issue here is one of consistency, isn't it? And you could go back through the recent history of the sprints and pick out incidents that have been perhaps more blatant. I get what you're saying, Richard. You know, Dora had right of way, if you like. Once you're in front and there's space behind, the assumption when you're watching is that the road belongs to the rider in front. But there's nothing in the rules to allow that, basically. The rule says you're forbidden to deviate from the lane. So according to the rule,
if it endangers others, is how I read the rule.
There is that clause there as well. And so then it becomes subjective. Was it endangering Vibus as she was coming up level and then kind of halfway up Dora? I'd be really fascinated to hear Ian's point of view on this.
I'll start by saying I was never a sprinter, so I don't really, you know what it's like to actually be, you know, traveling at those speeds in a bunch sprint. But having just been around the sport long enough and kind of seeing what's really evolved, not just here at this race today, but kind of over the whole season, starting with, you know, Jakobsen and Groenewegen, and then at the Tour with Sagan and Sam Bennett. I guess he was with Van Aert. But it seems like the UCI has kind of made an internal decision to really try and start limiting what riders are allowed to do once they're sprinting. You know, I think for a lot of us, it seems like, I mean, this particular instance, and doesn't really seem like she should have been relegated at all. I found the video online and looked at it, and I was like, this doesn't look, I mean, I didn't even notice that she was drifting at all. And, you know, it really kind of makes you wonder, like, well, what if they do want people to sprint in a straight line? I mean, what does the future of sprinting look like? They get to the last 200 meters and there's painted lines on the road and it becomes like a velodrome sprint. And if you have the sprint lane, then no one can pass you on a certain side. Sprinting it's an incredibly dangerous thing. And, you know, there's been a lot made of, you know, Groenewegen's crash in Tour of Poland with Jakobsen. And, you know, sprinters take incredible risk. And I mean, I'm very much of the opinion, if you're in front, you know, the people behind you are the ones that can really see what you're doing and they have the ability to brake and move. There has to be some clarity on this as far as what is actually deviating from your line. And today it doesn't seem like someone should have been relegated. But I mean, was it a couple weeks ago at Tirreno and Pascal Ackermann came up the inside and did this phenomenal move and slipped a gap and won the stage. And everyone was praising him for his bike handling skills, which was probably more dangerous than a rider on the front deviating their line, because if you're coming from behind, the sprinter can't oftentimes see you. And I know that, you know, there's been a lot made about, you know, sprinters need, you know, sprinting more carefully, but there's a good chance that in the sprint today, you're looking down at the road in front of you and you don't even really realize that you're deviating because there are no lines on the road.
Like I say, the Damar sprint in Brindisi with Sagan, that was a far more obvious deviation that was designed to close the door on Sagan, and there weren't really many calls for Damar to be relegated then, and I'm not sure that he should have been. I mean, when there's physical contact, I think that's when it becomes really dangerous. And that was the case with Groenewegen and Jakobsen, that was a factor in Jakobsen's crash. There's always a danger as well that you judge these maneuvers by their outcomes. And you know, we saw Ackermann last week at Skelderpriest as well pull a really dangerous maneuver, you know, really trying to get himself out of a boxed-in situation and veering quite dramatically and taking out some riders behind him. I think today was quite different. You know, Julien Dürr jumped hard and very skillfully, I thought, sort of nullified the threat from Vibus, who's very quick, and got that length or so lead that enabled her to then you know, close the door on the left-hand side and make it longer for Vibas to come round. Vibas then kept coming, and in the end was coming through quite a narrow gap. But that was her, that was on her. You know, that was her decision to keep going through that gap. I thought Dora didn't really do anything wrong. So I think that was a poor decision. But I think you're right, Lionel. It's the inconsistency is a problem. But all, I mean, I think the rule has to be vague because it has to be about whether a maneuver is dangerous or not, I think, ultimately. I think there has to be scope for riders to do things, you know, in different scenarios. Yeah,
but that's where it becomes absolutely subjective. And it's whoever's watching and making the decision. Because if Vibas had been quicker, it would have been more dangerous. I mean, that's, you know, if she'd been coming up quicker as the gap was closing, it would have been a more dangerous looking situation, and the risk of a collision or Vibas getting squeezed against the barriers would have been higher. But as she was kind of coming up initially, you know, not quickly enough to really you know, draw level with Duhura, then that, you know, the kind of the danger moment kind of passed, and the line came, and
she closed the Duhura. She closed the Duhura on her.
Somebody had to do it. I think, you know, again, I go back to that point I made about the rider in front. In the whole history of bike racing, the rider in front assumes that they have right of way. That it's, you know, as long as then it's not a kind of a real, you know, a slamming the door shut in somebody, which it certainly wasn't. It was a slow enough squeeze. I think I'm sympathetic to your point, Richard, that it was a harsh relegation, and one that if that's applied across all bunch sprints in every race, we're going to see some really we're going to see some sort of watered down sprinting. And that isn't me saying that what I want to see is, you know, elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder danger. I don't. I want it to be as safe as it possibly can. But at the end of the day, what people watching, and we all kind of get caught up in it, nobody wants to hit the ground. You know, nobody is thinking that they, you know, they want to come off badly in a sprint. So nobody is making a decision to, you know, everything is focused on getting to the line first, not thinking I'll have this person into the barriers. I mean, you know, and I think we kind of, from our detached position, we perhaps sometimes, you know, see danger where perhaps there wasn't any. It's absolutely subjective, I think.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you want 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code Lionel.
SISCP25.
Oh, never in doubt. SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. And thank you very much indeed to them. Well, I mentioned earlier on that the mugs that we've been selling, or Stacey Snyder has been selling, will go to benefit, among other good causes, the Black Cyclist Network. And Science and Sport are also big supporters of the Black Cyclist Network as well. That's nice to collaborate with them on that as well. On to the Giro then, stage 16 of the Giro d'Italia today, and a win for Jan Tratnik of Bahrain McLaren. Ben O'Connor up there with him, did a really good ride. He got away on the climb with Ben Swift and then dropped Swift, got across to Tratnik, and, you know, seemed to be in the driving seat to win the stage. A really much needed win that would have been for NTT, who are of course losing their sponsor in the year. And Ben O'Connor featured in our episode of Kilometre Zero that came out yesterday on that team. Did he make a bit of a mistake there, Ian, by not sort of, well, it would have been easier perhaps, or less difficult, had he caught Tratnik before the end of the climb and maybe gone straight past him? Easier said than done. But is there anything he could have done differently to try and beat him? Because you would have thought, coming from behind like that, he would have been the favorite, for all that Tratnik might have been a faster finisher.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that Tratnik played it pretty well in the fact that, you know, he didn't really take a pull the last K, which he didn't have to. And I think, yeah, had O'Connor caught him earlier on the penultimate climb and was able to maybe drop him there, he maybe would have been able to hold him off. But, you know, there's really not a lot to do when you're just not as fast. And I think, I mean, I was blown away when, you know, O'Connor attacked, Tratnik couldn't get away, and then Tratnik just went over the top of him and gapped him. And it just seemed like Tratnik was the stronger rider today. And who knows, maybe if, you know, Ben had, you know, kind of waited and brought Swift across and some other riders, then maybe it would have been a bit more dynamic. Sometimes when it's just one-on-one, it can be, you know, he knew that he had one spot to try and distance Tratnik, and he couldn't do it. But yeah, I mean, it was a heck of a ride by Trotnik. He was out there a long time, and I've spent some time racing with him, and he's an awesome guy. He's incredibly powerful, and it seems like he's always winning. Well, whenever he wins, he usually wins in a similar fashion from a breakaway or alone. He's a guy that, you know, clearly has a big engine on him.
Indeed. Well, he needed that engine today because it was a long, long stage, 229 kilometers. Pretty cruel the morning after the rest day. An early start, a real kind of jolt to the system after a day off from the racing. And Trotnik was in it was a huge break that went away, wasn't it? 28 riders in it. AG2R had four in there, including Larry Warbass. But it was when Manuele Boaro of Astana and Trotnik got clear. 50 kilometres plus from the finish, Trotnik was out there, either with Boaro or alone, and then later on with O'Connor, of course. And, really impressive ride by Trotnik. And a big boost for Bahrain McLaren, the first Grand Tour stage win of their season, first Grand Tour stage win for Rod Ellingworth since he's been at Bahrain McLaren. The other notable things from today were a sort of ding-dong battle for the King of the Mountains jersey. At the moment, Giovanni Visconti is in the blue jersey, but Ruben Guerrero is pushing him hard. Guerrero went over a couple of the climbs in front and then had a problem with his bike and he got stuck in the big rings, and Visconti took advantage of that. So Visconti still in the blue jersey, but that battle looks like it's got some way to go. And then at the finish, I mean, it was a strange day for the GC riders. We did see them kind of just riding sort of two by two and a little bit of through and off at one point, chatting away. Not putting too much into it. I'm always reluctant to say that because it's 229 kilometres in what looked like pretty chilly weather. But at the finish, Joao Almeida clipped away again and pinched another couple of seconds. So perhaps a little statement of intent, having conceded quite a chunk of his advantage on Sunday before the rest day, that he's not going to lie down and let Wilco Kelderman take the Giro from him. But big day tomorrow with Madonna di Campiglio, I think at around about 1500 meters. That stage certainly looks like it'll be fine weather wise so another big test for Almeida tomorrow.
It was a lot of effort by Almeida for not too much gain, I thought, in the end. Just a couple of things. You mentioned Larry Warbass was in that group. He's moved up to the top 20 overall, 19th overall, which is pretty decent. He's been in a couple of breaks. Well, Ben Swift is 23rd overall at the Giro d'Italia, which is quite remarkable. And I just wondered a question for Ian. Swift obviously wanting a stage win, and he was up there today. But, you know, there's been some talk of Tao Geoghegan-Hart being a real contender for overall victory here. Do you think that will be what they're thinking? And if so, it's not really the Ineos style, is it, to put someone in the breakaway when they've decided that, you know, they're going to get behind someone on GC. Ben Swift, potentially a really important guy for Tao Geoghegan-Hart over the coming days.
Given Tao's performance on Sunday, I think he's definitely been given, I mean, clear leadership role for GC, but I don't think that Ineos is going to put the resources towards it like they would if they had a, you know, Carapaz or Froome or Thomas there like we've seen in the past. I think it's going to be very much like a free role, and he'll have some riders to be around helping him, but riders, you know, they've already won, what is it, five stages at this tour or this Giro. So I think they're going to continue to hunt stages, and they'll support Tao when he's needed. But on a day like today, you know, having Swift up the road and, you know, going for his own ambitions, I don't think is really going to take away from Tao's, you know, desire to try and, you know, secure a podium finish. I wasn't joining you guys on Sunday, but yeah, that was a phenomenal performance from young Scotsman.
The young Ian Boswell, I like it. The young Ian Boswell doppelganger.
Yeah, well, I think he has...
You and he, not dissimilar in appearance.
No, he has more freckles than I do.
You know him well, Ian. I mean, how do you think he'll be approaching these next few days? I mean, it must be so tough to, you know, you've got fourth place in your hand, but anything, it could go either way, couldn't it? I mean, especially with
one second off third.
Stages. One second off third. There's something, you know, a small step forward and it could be a podium place or even better. That's the thing about this last week. It's very, very open. And although the gap itself is quite big, we just don't know how anyone will respond to, the bigger climbing stages. And when Beppe Martinelli, who's seen a few Grand Tour winners in his time, the boss of Astana, says that basically says Gegen Hart is the one to watch, if not the favourite. I mean, that's quite a statement. I mean, it could. There's no reason for Martinelli to kind of squeeze the pressure on Gegen Hart, because his guy Fuglsang is out of the picture. So that's not even mind games. You can't attribute that to mind games. So, I mean, how do you think Théo will be taking this?
I mean, it's a huge breakout performance. And I know Teo's kind of been knocking on the door. He had a good ride last year at Tour of the Alps, and he's kind of had a rough go at Grand Tours. You know, he hasn't really been able to put a great 3 weeks together. And I mean, just having spent time with him, I know he really wants, as any young rider does, they want to ride the Tour. He's built a really good relationship with Bernal. And I think that a performance like this, beyond just this Giro, you know, could really put him in the long list or the short list for next year's Tour de France. But I think, I think it's an awesome position for Théo, because I don't feel like there's a ton of pressure on him. He didn't go into the race with, you know, sole leadership. You know, obviously Thomas was there. He crashed out. And now, you know, Teo's in this position where he's able to go for, you know, a podium finish without really having the pressure and expectation. I'm sure there's kind of mounting internal pressure, just knowing Théo, you know, personally wanting to perform well. But I think as long as he can kind of just keep his head cool and doing what he does and not worrying about the consequences of attacking and, you know, going too deep, that, you know, he really could finish on the podium. And he's, you know, I say he's a young rider, but he's not all that young now. He's been in the World Tour for 4 or 5 years now. So he's experienced, you know, he's in a team that they know how to manage a rider of his position, and just, you know, being up there on GC, I think that, it's got to be incredibly motivating for the gingered Théo.
He's 25, which kind of passed it these days, isn't it? But speaking of mind games, Nibali said at the finish today that Kelderman, Wilco Man's biggest threat is perhaps Jai Hindley, his teammate, who he obviously observes as going very, very well. And, you know, if Théo Gegenhart is in with a chance of winning, then so is Jai Hindley, if Wilco Man falters. But I think you're right. You know, in Grand Tours, you know, momentum is important, isn't it? And Teo's got some momentum behind him. Wilco Man's kind of holding on to that momentum that he's had really from the start. But, you know, Nibali's such a kind of seasoned campaigner, and he, of all people, knows how these last stages in the high mountains, assuming they all run okay, the race could really turn on its head again. I mean, we might still see Nibali riding away with it, and then we'll look at that and go, well, that was always going to happen, wasn't it? Because that's what we do.
If that is the case, I mean, I would point back to today's stage and the fact that, you know, it was a hard finishing circuit that they did, and the fact that none of the big GC contenders outside of Almeida made a move, you know, could be a sign that, you know, Nibali is plotting something for the high mountains. Because had he wanted to, you know, try something and, you know, snag a few seconds, I'm sure he could have tried something like that today. Maybe it wouldn't have worked, but, you know, the fact that he didn't try anything today could be a sign that he is plotting something for the days to come.
Well, there was some other news from the Giro this morning, wasn't there, when it was announced that a rider from UAE Team Emirates, who it later emerged was Fernando Gaviria, and the staff member at AG2R, who I gather is the team chef, had tested positive for coronavirus. Gaviria, of course, was one of the people who was at the UAE Tour way back in the spring when coronavirus kind of hit pro cycling. It was certainly the first sport to really be hit by the coronavirus situation, and Gaviria was in hospital. What we can't really say is whether or not this coronavirus positive means that he's been reinfected or not. All we know at the moment is that he is positive, and so did not start the stage today. Joe Dombrowski, who's been keeping an audio diary for us, he has sent in a report of what happened from his perspective.
Hi, guys. So, yeah, obviously a pretty eventful overnight for us when we learned that Fernando was positive. We got a message from Michele De Grandi, our team doctor here, just everyone to stay in their rooms and just not really to do anything until we got further instruction. Then someone arrived and did a second test, which apparently was also positive. In regards to Max, he's had a cough, an ongoing cough that's been problematic for him, which is why he stopped today. But there was someone arriving actually last night, not from the Giro organization, but from the World Health Organization, did 2 full PCR tests on him and confirmed that he was 100% negative, just because we wanted to be totally safe. For the rest of the team, we were all negative. We have not been tested yet as a follow-up, but from what I understand, we are meant to be tested again, I think, tonight, and that may continue going forward for the next days, just because obviously we've all been in relatively close contact. You know, there were 2 positives coming out of the race today, one with Fernando and one of the staff in AG2R, and we were both in the same hotel the last 4 days. So I would imagine that we may have continued tests just to err on the side of caution. Obviously, you know, we do all that we can, and in terms of, there's been people sanitizing the room every night. You know, we're wearing the masks everywhere, lots of hand sanitizer, and just trying to maintain distance. And yeah, I mean, it's disappointing. We were all just, all us riders were just kind of sitting in the lobby in the hotel last night, not really sure what to think. We didn't really have all the information at the time, and I was concerned even whether we were all going to start tomorrow or not. But in the end, it was limited to only Fernando. Max did DNF today, and he has had a cough, but we've confirmed with further testing that it's not related to COVID. And he actually had COVID already back in UAE Tour. Me personally, I'm just fine. And yeah, we're looking forward to the rest of the week. Obviously, it's a little disappointing to lose one of your teammates, but it's a pretty strange year for everyone. And I think we just have to do everything we can to look out for public health.
There's another round of coronavirus testing for all of the teams. The first batch tonight, roughly half of the teams are being tested tonight, including UAE Team Emirates, and the other half will be tested tomorrow night after the stage. No indication as to whether UAE Team Emirates will be subject to additional monitoring. As Joe explained, Max Richese also pulled out of the race today. He's been coughing, but it's not coronavirus related, so that's something. And it does seem after the first wave of positive tests, you know, one rider and one staff member from the next serious batch of testing, it does feel like the Giro will make it to the finish, touch wood, as long as there aren't further positive tests from this next round of coronavirus tests. I just wanted to say something about the Vuelta, Rich, because there were a couple of, there were 3 riders who didn't finish the first stage today, including former Vuelta stage winners Mateus Frank and Alexandre Geniez, and also one of the debutants, Sunweb's Ilan Van Wilder. He was one of 48 riders making their Grand Tour debut in this Vuelta. So out of a field of 176, 48 have never ridden a Grand Tour before. That's obviously a consequence of this season being packed into a couple of months or so. But Ian, will that have any bearing on the racing, do you think, that there's a lot of riders that haven't done a 3-week race before?
Yeah, the fact that there are so many new riders definitely could play into the, you know, the overall race. And I think we even potentially saw that today with, you know, a lot of first time Grand Tour riders are really told to, you know, take it easy. It's 3 weeks, you know, save yourself. And there could be a lot of riders, you know, we could see some big gruppettos with riders, you know, just making sure that they can endure 3 weeks of racing. But that said, you know, just to contradict myself, we've seen so many young riders, you know, in their first Grand Tours really excel. So it really depends on the riders. And it has been a kind of a crazy couple months with packed in racing, but yeah, that's an awful lot of debutants at one Grand Tour, and it kind of brings the Vuelta back to the old days of the Vuelta when it was oftentimes the first Grand Tour that riders would be sent to.
And just briefly, and the 2 races going on at the same time, as you reflect on your career, do you have a favorite out of the Giro and the Vuelta?
Oh, I mean, I only did 1 Giro in my career. I did 3 Vueltas. I just loved racing in Spain. You know, this year is different because the Giro is all of a sudden in October, but I just love the style of racing of Spanish roads. And, you know, oftentimes the weather's going to be better. And, you know, I kind of touched on it last week when I was with you guys, that Italian racing has a very distinct characteristic of how the race is done. And that's, you know, kind of why I thought Ulisse tends to perform well in Italy. And it's a style of racing that never really suited me as much as racing in France or in Spain. Yeah. Things are just a little bit less chaotic racing in Spain than racing in Italy.
Well, Ian, I think you'll be joining us again, won't you, later in our grandest tour coverage, by which time it'll just be the Vuelta.
Yeah, that'll be easy. Just one race, one race a day.
And you're off fishing in the meantime, is that right?
I am, yes. I'm going on what is becoming an annual fishing trip with my younger brother. Put away my computer, nice. Telephone, and recording device for a week, and head off
got,
on
we
the
got
river
all your Shima- got all your Shimano reels and stuff.
Oh, I wish. Yeah, I was always surprised when I got into fishing and realized that Shimano also makes fishing equipment.
Durace. Electronic.
electronic fishing equipment.
I used to be a very keen fisherman myself, though. Ian, can you tell me where you're going and what you're fishing for?
Heading out to the border between Oregon and Idaho on the Snake River, and we'll be catching... Well, I was out there last year, actually. Yeah, you should try to come out one year, Richard, for it.
Love to.
But yeah, we'll be catching steelhead, salmon, bass, trout, and we also last year caught a few sturgeon, which I'm not sure it's... I mean, this was a 10-foot, it's like a 3-meter long fish. It's like a dinosaur.
Wow.
They're just like a big bottom feeder. We'll be catching some sturgeon. Those will not be on fly rods. That's on like a semi down, like, you know, deep ocean type rig. It's a float trip. So we'll be on rafts floating down the river and fishing along the way.
That sounds great. I love it.
It does.
I want a full report on that when you get back. And
we'll do an episode of Explore on Ian's fishing trip.
Yeah, on a pedalo. Are you, tomorrow night, is it Francois Thomas will joining us tomorrow night, Lionel?
I think it is, yes.
And Lizzie Banks will be joining us as well for some episodes. In the meantime, can we just say a few thank yous to friends of the podcast? Very grateful indeed to those of you who've signed up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And from me, a big thanks to Declan McKernan, David McCook, Jonathan Cornelius, Sean Dwyer, Stephen Price, Jason Harriman and Philip Scott.
And thank you to Richard Gorski, Alexandra Jacques, Lawrence Colby, Lewis Patterson, Thomas McElligott, Jaime Garcia Nogales, and Malcolm Hart.
And last but not least, Christy Howard, Mark Middleton, Henry Engels, Colin Gerzbowski, Piers Rendell, Mark Prendville, Mark Childerstone, Robert Graham, and Yez Nabarro.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.